Remember this? Do you remember this?
Oh, Island of the Lizard King. Yeah, that was a good one as well.
Island of the Lizard King. That was a good one.
I've got the Forest of Doom to take on. We're going City of Thieves.
This book here, I have to confess, this book here is one of the only things I've ever stolen in my entire life.
Yes,
I did actually steal it from Billingham Rosebery Library. I do apologize for that. I was only five, but you know, it was just, I loved the book so much. It was that I had to keep it. I might have just declared a crime on TV on live stream. Shit, I need to go and like start funding that library. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 106. We're bringing it to you every Friday, and we've got an amazing show for you today, principally because both Adam and I think know nothing about this topic. This is going to be really interesting, like an educational experience for us, because we're talking about hiring C-level people. Like, are you in a recruiting role where someone's actually come to you and say, listen, we need a new CEO, or we need a new like CTO, or somebody like super, super important in your business? No one's ever correctly trusted me with that responsibility, but we're going to bring on people that do this job and have, you know, I'm currently trading in this way. What are the challenges of hiring at that level where, you know, there's all kinds of things you can't do, incumbent in place, you can't publicly advertise the job. What is the sales cycle for this thing? Maybe 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, who knows? Loads of exciting things. Anyway,
I know that I always seem a bit needy. I'm going to start sounding a bit needy here. And like, you know, I've got some experience, because you always say like, Adam and I know nothing about this. I was a divisional managing director at exec search firm Norman Broadbent for 4 years.
I totally forgot about that. I thought you, for some reason, I knew you were at PwC and you did some social media agency or something. Adam, but you actually were at Norman Broadbent. I had no clue.
4 years. Yeah, Adam and I, he always does this. Adam and I know nothing about employer brand. I'm like, you know, I started an employer brand in 2002. So
I'm just trying to get company in my ignorance.
I'm going to send you my CV one day. I am going to send you my CV one day.
I would actually love to see it. And I think everyone would love to see it, actually. Would you be interested in seeing Adam's CV? I think that would be a document we'd all love to pore over. Okay, let's do a quick sound check before we kick off. We are multicasting, everybody. So I think you can hear me on Crowdcast, I believe. Yes, you can hear me, I believe. So this is great. Can you hear me on LinkedIn? LinkedIn Live, folks. We are broadcasting on my LinkedIn personal profile. So if you can hear me there, give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down, something to that order. Let me just check it on my mobile phone because I don't have two screens. Yes, I think I'm on LinkedIn. That's fine. And also on Facebook Live. Can you hear me, folks? If you can, give me a thumbs up. Let me know whether we're good. Actually, no, I know we're not good because I need to press play. This is why I have to check. Cool. All right, perfect. We are definitely live on Facebook now, which is great stuff. Okay, let's kick off with a few things. Word of thanks, firstly, for our sponsors today. I'm very pleased to announce an inaugural sponsorship of a really cool network. Not a business, but really a network of corporate exec search leaders. This is E6, Executive Search Information Exchange. This is one of the most venerable and I think valuable communities that most people don't know about, because if you're recruiting at exec search level and you know you're not able to really freely interact with lots of other recruiters that operate at more kind of operational recruitment type level, the stuff you can simply can't talk about. So I think it's really interesting that there is a network that exists to support this. I'm going to share the link in it here. It is a PayPal network, I believe, but it may be worth your business sponsoring you to get involved here. They're not expecting you to come out of your own pocket, but if you're working in corporate in-house and you're not part of this network, I think you can make a very easy case for your business to support you to be part of it. I just shared the link in there. There you go. Vanessa said, very highly recommend E6. They've also got a book as well. Simon sent me this signed copy, fantastic book by Simon Mullins. So thank you for that. Do check them out. Okay.
Can I just back that up, by the way? Yeah, excellent. I've been at, I think it might just be one, but I presented talent pipeline management at one of their meetings, which was at visa around probably 3 years ago, but the people who were there were all from companies that you want to be networking with, and the quality of the discussion both there and afterwards at the bar, where somebody got an entire pint dropped over him, I remember, by a waiter. But yeah, no, it was really great networking and great discussion, and Simon's got a great initiative there for sure.
Yeah, amazing. And you know, I think this type of thing is I'm a big fan of communities. So you know, I think you learn so much more from your peer group than anybody else. So just get involved in it. If you haven't heard of E6, please just check it out. And like I say, loads of testimonials to say you need to be part of it. It's part of your career. Just get involved. Okay, let's kick off with this. So the newsletter last week, Adam, I actually screwed up. You're very kind in not sort of flagging that up, actually. So thank you for that. But I sent it accidentally on Friday. I hope you still managed to get it and were able to read it. If so, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, to be honest.
Right. So a couple of things to talk about. The first one is, I struggle a little bit to take advice from LinkedIn, given the suggestions that they give you for automatic reply messages.
Right.
When somebody sends you a message and it's like, you know, the suggested reply is like, nice one, dude, or something like that, like completely inappropriate. But anyway, they have given us, using some data, recommendations, mails, and a couple of the things to point out are the best in-mails are shorter ones. The best time, best day of the week to send your in-mails is any day except for a Saturday. Personalized messages get a 20% better response rate, which I thought sounded very, very low. And people who have marked open to work are 75% more likely to respond, which is pretty obvious. But the article's worth reading. I've just given like some of the top level statistics that I took from it. And so I thought it was interesting.
I think so. I mean, anytime LinkedIn are a mover in our business, you know, if they're able to aggregate content from all of the in-mails that are ever sent and then say, actually, this works better than others, I think it makes perfect sense for you to avail yourself of them. So, you know, everyone's a critic of in-mails, aren't they? You know, it's part of a badge of honor as a recruiter. Say, yeah, in-mails, we don't use them. You know, I'm a proper recruiter. But they're there. So, I mean, you can use them. So you might as well get better at it if the facility's there. And so the stats here seem to suggest there's some things you can do, like word length and length of title and stuff like this. Classic stuff. Go ahead and check that link out. Just share it in the chat stream there, folks. So make yourself, avail yourself to that. Okay, what else, man?
I also enjoyed the article about psychological safety. Which is something that has appeared a few times recently. So it's obviously a hot topic. And I enjoyed the information from Google, which is that teams with strong psychological safety have better retention, better and more diverse ideas. They make more money, and they are twice as likely to be marked as effective by one of their peers inside Google. So another really interesting one, a subject I don't know an awful lot about, but one that is quite tangible. Yeah, it's quite easy to understand, because we've all been in circumstances where we feel psychological safety or the opposite. And but one that should be more at the forefronts of our mind, especially if we're managers.
Yeah, I think critical as a manager. And in fact, I didn't realize the term psychological safety emerged from a HR study at that Google sort of event. So that term, I think we're all familiar with, it's gone into the mainstream, actually a HR term, folks. And I think it's really important, because if you're fearful of contributing in your work environment for whatever reason, you're always second guessing, or you're always on edge. It's almost like being in a relationship with somebody, or in a bad relationship with somebody, and you're always on eggshells because you don't know, you know, you're just terrified of some, you know, they're going to kick off because you say the wrong thing or whatnot. There's an overreaction. So that is an example of a lack of psychological safety. Now, if you're a manager, your job is basically to ensure that situation doesn't occur within your team. And that every member of the team feels as if they're not on eggshells, and they're able to contribute and not, and even have, you know, opinions that differ from other people, but not feel as if that's going to have some sort of negative impact on, you know, their future career or whatever it might be. Very, very difficult thing to manage, but that's a post I think people should read, and, you know, particularly managers who want to get better at this.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about facial analysis.
Yep.
So, you know, there are a number of technologies out there that do facial analysis in recruitment, and they can determine from your speech patterns and the way that you're interacting. I mean, I don't know if they can tell if you're lying or not, but they certainly can determine certain things about you. But there's a number of big problems with this. The first thing is that they're not reliable yet. They don't necessarily know. I mean, they probably know the difference between Hung and I, but they're not going to know the difference between, you know, quite a lot of people that look a bit more similar. So there's that problem about the reliability aspect of it. There's a second aspect of it, which is clearly very much an ethical thing. So who's building the algorithms in here, and what are they actually asking the machine to determine? If somebody's like slopes to the left, does that mean that they're going to be great at their job? You know, I mean, obviously that's ridiculous, but there's just too many elements of this that are open to bias, and, you know, AI, you know, infiltrated bias. So I'm not sure this is one that should take off. I think it's, and especially in the EU, of course, where I like to think of us still in the EU, and it's really sad that we're not, of course, but sorry for the political message there. But, you know, in the EU, which I think should be leading the world, it does lead the world in all of ethical, you know, aspects to do with human rights and how we treat recruitment and HR related things. That's not really going to fly, and I think it shouldn't elsewhere either.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, this post wrote by Jan Tegze, who is a massive critic of this type of technology. He's kind of put together, I think, quite a compelling argument against. So I shared it in the chat stream there. Go check that post out. You should follow Jan anyway. Really good recruiter and commentator. I'm more sympathetic to the usage of almost any technology, to be honest. I'm one of these to say, yeah, go ahead and push through. But I do recognize that it's problematic. And there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that there's some negative outcomes as a result of how we've designed some of these systems. I would say that's different, though, from saying these systems shouldn't be designed. I don't think we're at the point where we can say we're not going to use it, which actually I think the EU is kind of moving towards. So I'm not sure whether that's the correct move by the EU, even though I think it'll have a lot of sympathy. I just think you can do this better. And the primary thing I've got as an argument for usage of this technology, including facial recognition, is that the, you know, what are you comparing it against? You know, I think if you compare anything against perfect, then of course it's going to fall short. But I prefer to compare it to what we have now, which is human beings doing that scrutiny. And I put it to you, human beings are obviously biased, and in many cases more so than a machine might be. So even though it is flawed, I do think it's incrementally better, in which case we should not throw it out. Baby with the bathwater from my side on that.
We're at the point now where there's so many different possibilities with technology and recruitment, and there's going to be a lot of differing opinions around what we should be ruling in and ruling out as, like, you know, things that should go mainstream. And if you look at something like Tengai, which has created you know, a lot of diverse opinions, very much Marmite opinion, I think that there's all sorts of reasons why that's a great experience for candidates and all that kind of thing. But yeah, the facial recognition thing, I believe, is taking things a little bit too far. But I don't disagree with you around we should be trying things to see what's going to be good and what's not.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's probably a debate we'll have at another Brain Food Live. I think it's worth setting that one up because we care about it. You know, and we're going to be subject to it at some point, I would imagine. Okay, let's talk about the topic, man. Before we bring our guests on, give us your wisdom with your 4 years experience as divisional manager of Northern Broadbent. What is the difference, one difference, between being a sort of an exec leadership recruiter compared to a normal recruiter? Normal, I don't denigrate that. It's just like you're hiring for people that aren't at that sort of C-level positioning. What is the difference? One thing that you can say.
I don't think there's one thing. I think there's a lot of things. I mean, it's a different methodology. It's a very, very different way of doing things. Norman Broadbent was more like a management consultancy than like a recruitment, you know, a recruitment agency business. It wasn't the same. It wasn't the same environment. Very different types of people, very, very research-led, you know, and of course, everything's retained. So, you know, you're working on that, you're being paid to work on that, and the quality of the output. You can't cut corners in terms of the quality of the output. So I also run every 2 months, I run an online group for people that are in-house exec resourcing people, and we cover different subjects every time, and it's fascinating. But the one thing that's the number one every single session we do, diversity is absolutely the number one topic. So I would expect us to cover that today.
That's interesting. Let's bring on some guests, Adam. I'm going to bring on, by the way, we're going to kind of bring in these in a running order because I think everyone's got slightly different kind of ways to think about this. I'm going to bring Jane Redden on first because I want to speak to Jane. I haven't spoken to her for ages, actually. So this is a great opportunity to connect. But also, you know, she's been talking a lot about leadership recently. So I wanted to get a little bit of a handle on this. There she is. Jane, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
No, wonderful to see you, Jane. I think it's been like probably several years since we've had the chance to catch up. So really nice to see you.
I follow you. I love your pictures. So yeah, and you'll hear a lot more from me this year because I'm about to write down my entire hiring methodology and share it with you, Hung, so you can have my entire life's work.
I'm very excited. Jane, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself to the crowd, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the talent director at Albion VC. I am a 25-year veteran of recruiting senior leaders for startups and disruptive companies across Europe and the US.
You know what? She put in the 25 years veteran experience just to probably promote her skincare range. because there's no way you look like you've done me no work for 25 years.
Good Lord. It's yoga, isn't it, Jane? That's your...
It is. Some people are just like permanently youthful. But Jane, I was reminded about your thinking about the leadership side. So you're working for a VC, obviously talent spotting, you're looking at leaders, like this company's worth backing or this possibly that leader is not the right person. What is that? Like, what are you looking for? It seems to me like so amorphous. Is it good feel? And that's okay to say if it's good feel, or is there anything else around the idea of leadership? Is there something you look for?
Yeah, great question. It's a science and an art, and leadership is definitely contextual. So you've got to have a number of tools in your toolkit to be able to flex and to form depending on the leadership challenge that you're facing. When hiring senior leaders, though, into a team, a VC and an investor or a board is really are looking to the answer for the answer to one question. And that's, can this team, this leadership team, deliver the growth strategy? So whatever their leadership style is, as a leadership team, they have to deliver the growth strategy. A leader and a founder is looking for the answer to the question, how do I build that leadership team? And what I do is I sit in the middle of that dynamic and I bring my expertise and tools and techniques and hacks, really, to help them hire and then get the best out of that leadership team.
So, Jane, you've said something really interesting here. You're saying that leadership is contextual. So, as I understand this, you're saying that a leader A may actually be a, a poor fit for a certain context, because that is not suitable. That style of leadership or that personality of leadership is not right for that place. So leadership may not be a single trait then. It's actually needs to, you need to look at the local context.
You need to look at the blend and look at, you know, again, sort of making this specific to hiring just for the audience here. The power tool of all power tools in my playbook is the scorecard.
Right.
The scorecard enables you to articulate ahead of time the blend of skills and experience and style, leadership style, and fit all with growth in mind, because I only work in growth or transformation. You know, it's a bit of change, but mostly it's all about growth. Is how do you articulate what is required to hit the growth strategy? And so, I don't know. Shall I unpack the scorecard a bit? I don't know.
100%. Yeah.
Okay. So the perhaps I should back up. Shall I back up and talk about the hiring mindset a bit first, just to try and give you in a few minutes sort of what
Oh, by the way, before you do that, has anybody got any questions for Jane? Please use the ask a question section at the bottom, and we'll come to those at a later point. Okay, that's true for all the guests. So ask the question, use that function. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, so hiring mindset. The for me, the key difference between IC level hiring and senior level hiring is that in both of those cases, it's a buying and selling experience. But what I pay much more attention to is the psyche and the decision making psyche. In other words, what's in it for me? And why am I going to say yes to this? And why am I going to say no to this of the person who I'm going to hire? So I spend much more time thinking about them and thinking about their personal motivations. The next thing that you've got to get right as a sort of in your hiring team on the buying side, if you like, is that you have to get clarity and alignment on what you're looking for before you set off. The best way to do that is to set it into a hiring playbook. And I've got, again, I'm going to publish it later this week. So watch this, later this year. So watch this space for that. But inside the hiring playbook sits a scorecard, which enables you to effectively measure, turn into data, the blend of skills and experience, style, contextual strengths, so role strengths, and leadership capabilities which are required to your growth strategy, depending on what your growth strategy is, on one grid. So it's got stripes. Think stripes of a beach ball. Think at Balderson, I used to use jelly and trifle as a way to explain this for those that don't think in grids.
Dessert. I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
And then I realized that he doesn't transport to Europe. So I shifted it to croque monsieur. So if anybody's listening in Europe and they don't know what jelly or trifle is at all, then you can just think, you know, toast. If you only just measure toast, then you basically just get one taste. But if you measure toast and your cheese and your ham and your pickle, and then you put another slice of toast on top, then you have a much greater palate. It's much richer. It's much more tasty as a blend of flavors to be able to design the specific scorecard, the specific skill set, the specific match that you're looking for in your senior leader.
So let me interrupt there, Jane. You're saying you need to design this prior to any search. So this is not like at the moment, it might be later used to assess those candidates coming through, but you need to design this before you go out. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, look, and this is another really interesting point, right? The hiring mindset, the best teams who hire senior leaders well do it as a team effort. It is a team sport. It's got a team captain, and it's usually got a quarterback, which is quite often me. And in the middle, you've got a team who play different roles. Think defense, think midfield, think attack. And what we'll do is we'll build this hiring playbook, inside of which sits this hiring scorecard, which is really clearly articulated. It's got five stripes. To repeat, those stripes are track record, role strengths, cultural fit values, leadership or edge qualities required to achieve the growth strategy, and personal motivations. We'll plot those in small, pithy words. It's an internal hiring tool. It doesn't go out to candidates. And then as a team, you're accountable for across a five-stage process. So kickoff, you as a team are responsible for that kickoff. The planning before you set off on a search, go slow on that in order to go fast on the rest. Then if you're going to outsource sourcing I call it identify. So I mean, who you're going to identify, that's where Adam was talking about the research. Then you're talking about engaging your candidates, then assessing candidates, and then hiring. Five distinct stages with key accountabilities assigned in each of those stages. And so what will happen is, before you set off, your hiring team will get together and they will write this playbook and write the scorecard down, including both the it's basically a competency grid, but say you've got 20 criteria on your scorecard. You can then rank or weight the scorecard to pick the top 5 or 6. I have a rule, maximum 8. And then you'll assign, as the team captain, an assessment stage. You'll assign 2 to 3 competencies for each person on your team to test for with evidence, structured interviewing, to pull that back into a more holistic view. And that helps you get much more objectivity and rigor into the assessment process and gives you a much greater chance of finding what you said right at the beginning, which is the match. The match is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, Andy, thank you so much for writing that stuff down. I'm glad someone was paying attention. So yeah, well done, Keane. Brilliant. Well, Jane, thank you so much for giving us that overview. I'm like really enthusiastic. I don't want to recruit somebody. Yeah, you know.
You just caught that. And I'm super happy to share all of my tools, any of my, you know, any of the methodology, you know, totally open. I really believe in, I've just basically tested it and iterated it. Since 1997, when I first started recruiting for startups, the conventional way of hiring was effectively broken, because people made a hiring decision based on whether they'd done it before or whether they liked them. Well, at the beginning of the startup journey, nobody had done any of these things before. And quite often, you've got to find a proxy, right? So that was null and void. And then the second piece, which is, do I like them, is it absolutely 100% biased. So now what do? So I started working into these scorecards about 25 years ago, and I've basically iterated it since then. And so I know it works. I've got pick lists that you can choose competencies from and just ways to hack it and get there quicker. The basic message is, yeah, get clarity and alignment before you set off, and a scorecard is the best way to do that.
That's really, really fascinating. And by the way, if anybody wants to follow Jane, just follow her on LinkedIn. I've just shared it on the chat stream over there. Jane Elizabeth Redding, in case you're not on the Crowdcast. Okay, this is really fascinating, Jane. Adam, you about to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask Jane a question. So you used a few sports analogies there. Do you sit at home and talk to your husband in sports analogies all day?
Yeah, basically.
Right. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, look, and it's true, right? Because leadership in sports and is really similar to leadership in startups. Like, this is and perhaps that is the final point. A high performing leadership team should be toxic, but isn't toxic. And as a leader and as a hiring leader, think less about whether you like someone and more about whether you can trust someone. Think more about whether you trust them to deliver against the growth objective, whether you want to go into battle with them, whether you want to go out on that field to play with them, whether you would take a bullet for them, whether you would put your body in the line of the ball. You know, all of those analogies and similarities are real. And
You're reminding me of the All Blacks here, because to go a bit into rugby, the All Blacks kind of method for this is around, you know, everybody needs to be, it doesn't matter if they like each other, they have to trust each other to be the best possible person in every single different position, and they've all got a different job to do.
Yeah.
That's just like a startup.
Yeah, look, and it's also like that when you're hiring, right? So if you've got a bunch of, like, the worst teams who hire leaders badly, in my opinion, they kind of go, well, you know, look, here's his CV. Could you just go and have a chat? And so you have 5 conversations on repeat with a candidate, which delivers a poor candidate experience. Instead, what you think of is, okay, so we're recruiting a CTO. What's the CTO archetype that we're really interested in? Have we mapped that? Do we understand their psyche? Do we know what they're going to be motivated by? Do we know how we're going to land them? Okay, so now how do we deliver a buying and selling experience so that we can assess with rigor whether they actually and objectively match what we want them to do? So ask a question. You know, they join in 18 months' time, they have smashed it out of the park. What have they done? Start there, then write that down. Then that gives you performance in role, your objectives. Then you get into your scorecard. Then you split your scorecard up into two to three areas per person. Then they test that. And you're also quarterbacking this. Okay, so how can we deliver on hooking this candidate in such that we're firing up their limbic system? They really want to join us more than just, you know, the salary, because quite often we don't have money, right? You've got to find other levers. We don't have cash. And that's one of the ways that you can do that.
I want to throw a curveball into this, Jane. So all of this sounds like you're hiring, like you've got the team on board, right? There's a hole in the team and you're trying to fill it.
Yeah.
That's great. What if the hole's actually filled with the wrong person currently? So I think a lot of leadership hiring has that situation, right? If you're a smart CEO, you actually might be aware your CTO or whoever it is not the right person. But you're not in a position, or you don't think it's right to get rid right now, but you want to get the ball rolling, so to speak, and start talent pipelining using Adam's term and all this type of stuff. But yeah, you've got to do it like in a subterranean way. So how does that work? Or would you say the methodology you've described is useful for it when it's completely transparent and open, but you've got to have a different way to do it if incumbent in place, let's say?
Yeah.
Can I just quickly answer that question, by the way? Because it's not necessarily just that. It may also be that Albion knows that the CEO or the founders are not the right people to take the role, to take the organization to the next stage of growth. So it could be not just...
Could even be the CEO, right? Often is. Like, that's not the right person to do this. So how do you do it so surreptitiously?
Yeah, great question. So then go one step removed. And find you've got to get a team around you who can hold the confidence. As soon as you go to market, and then do loads of planning work first, right? As soon as you go to market, it's absolutely an egg timer. So you want to try and try to hold tightly to the team who knows on the inside, until you talk to people kind of outside. So don't set off fast and think you'll just work it out when you go along. The scorecarding will show up in you can assess easily the current incumbent against the scorecard, and you can start to really draw in an unemotional way based on capabilities and competencies, how the individual is either stacking up or not stacking up. So that's already a very useful exercise, and it doesn't take long, right? We can do them in 90 minutes. You can fill them out in 90 minutes. It's really clarifying. It makes loads of difference to everybody's understanding once you've got it written down. But you know, broadly speaking, I mean, I would say be really aware that you need about 6 weeks before you start a search to go through the process with the people who are going to make a decision on the hire potentially, or who can hold the confidence that you're about to make a transition. And then once you go out to market, you have to have a communication strategy in place, because it will leak. Like, I do confidential searches all the time, and I tell people now, once we turn this over, this is an egg timer, right? And we're going, we've got to go fast. So don't be naive to that.
Final question for you, Jane. By the way, I want you to come back after we kind of cycle you off, right? So that's a terrible thing to say, is cycle off, or am I done? No. Would this not be appropriate time? This is why you would engage maybe an external firm, though. There's a moment where, let's say it is so quiet, like it may be like someone who's there's no way that you can even start this without this person, because this person may be politically powerful, let's say, or they may have lots of, you know, there's the loss of loyalty in business, whatnot. Yeah. Could be all kinds of like crazy chaos. But this is where you might want to push it out externally and brief a headhunter, a Norman Broadbent, let's say, or a Korn Ferry, someone like that, and say, look, I need this like completely shtum, but you got to start building me a network of people that I can speak to and get ready to go. Is that the case? And if so, how do you start that conversation? How do you make sure you're selecting the right search firm to deliver to you?
Yeah, great question. Yes, you can. And you have to take accountability for the scorecard yourself as a senior leader. I work very fruitfully, and I've got long-standing relationships with lots of search firms. They're great at what they do, and they are exceptional brand megaphones, and they've got lots of, yeah, as Adam said, lots of rigor in their process. Don't let a search firm, in my opinion anyway, don't let a search firm tell you that they can give you the answer. You've got to work out the scorecard for yourself. It's your company, it's your business, it's your board. Do it with your board before you let a search firm do it. And then have the search firm take accountability for both identifying and engaging candidates. That's the accountabilities they have. You've got accountability for the kickoff or the plan and for assessing and hiring candidates. That's how you share it.
Yep.
The next question you asked was, how do you choose a search firm? I've got a model of 5 C's that I will describe to every single founder that we're looking, that I work with, and I can share it with you now if you want to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got Andy there going to write this down. So, yeah, you totally share it.
I'm taking notes as well here, by the way.
The first C is creds, right? You've got to know what they've done. And I want to know who they've hired, not which mandates they've done. And it's got to be within the last 12 to 18 months. So once you know what you're looking for, then you can match it, right? Creds specifically to do with that match. The second is cost, which is real for startups, because they, you know, it is an expensive endeavor, right? It's really expensive to do this, and the cost of not doing this is a fortune. So, yeah, get that clear. The third thing is confidence as a brand ambassador. I really want to know, do they get what we're about? Can they accurately articulate the breakdown of the archetypes? Are they able to tell us where they're going fishing for the fish that we want to hook and why? Are they able to convince the fish to go in the net? Can they do that, right? We practice with them on that. It's really important. They've got to be able to do that in a way which you believe is almost better than you can. Fourth is commitment. Are they hungry to do this? Will they go the extra mile? Will they dig into this 200-hour search project? And are they going to be as enthusiastic at an hour 180 as they are today? Fifth, trump card. Absolutely 100% the trump card. It's chemistry. If at any point in that conversation with a headhunter, you think, doesn't matter why, Don't even ask yourself why. If you think that they're a jerk, if you think that something they say is a little bit off, if something that it just irritates you, doesn't matter what it is, don't go with them. Choose someone else.
Okay, Andy, I need an update on this. So please share the notes if you're still with us. Okay, Jane, this is amazing. I really do want to, I'm going to bring you back later on, but I'm going to bring on Alia and Keen right now, because I want them to talk about their experience. They're probably working with startups that are at a different stage, and I want to just follow that through. So Jane Redden, thank you so much for your contribution so far. We're an amazing set of insights there. That was great, wasn't it? Okay, we definitely need to get Jane. I'm now kind of disappointed I haven't brought Jane on sort of previous to this. This is her debut on Brain Food Live. So yeah, I think so. I don't know why. I mean, there's no reason why not. So
I've known Jane for quite some time, and we've done quite a lot of things together. And the most fun was employer brand blind date at RecFest a few years ago. That was a lot of fun. She was still right. Black.
Let me just thank Andy there, who is just making these amazing notes. Andy, you are this. If this is not your professional job, I might hire you to make notes on Brain Food Lives. These are fantastic. Okay, so let's welcome our next guest. This is Keen August and Alia Khattab. Keen, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, sir?
Sure. Hi, everybody. First of all, to the two of you, thank you very much for having me on. My background is 30 plus years in recruiting. Most of that in executive recruiting, the first half of which was in search firms, much like Adam, building them and taking them down again and buying them, etc. And then the last 15 years in the corporate world, for very large tech businesses like HP and SAP, and then more recently in scale-ups such as where I am today in Zalando.
Fantastic. And Keen, great to have you on the show. Alia, great to meet you. For the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for having me. Nice to meet you. I will remember you stole a book at 5 years old. That's going to stick with me. But no worries, that's not the subject for today. So I'm coming from a humble perspective. I don't have 20 years experience, 12 years, last 3 years on executive hiring, currently with ServiceNow. Those who don't know ServiceNow, we're one of the we are one of the fastest growing enterprise software company today. We announced our results 2 days ago, another double-digit growth. So it's been quite a journey, which I'm happy to share.
Amazing. And the reason why I wanted to bring you both on together, because I feel that the exec search at the scale-up phase may be different from the exec search at the startup stage, which is where Jane was focusing on, I think. So where would you see are the main differences in kind of the maturity of the company when it comes to exec, or is it the same? I mean, is exec search the same? Does it just kind of translate across the maturation of a company, or is there some changes that we need to be aware of you working for a company that's really, you know, growing at this extraordinary pace? Thoughts on that, on this, anybody?
I'd like to kick that one off, because I think there's, having worked for both types of organization, the biggest thing for me really is about education of the leadership that you're hiring, you know, who is your hiring manager? Because in an environment like SAP, and now you're, Alia, you're working with Bill McDermott, who I worked for many years with, and is a hugely accomplished hiring manager. In fact, he's practically a recruiter in his approach and his way of working. And it is somebody that you can really work with and talk with and consult with on at a really deep level. There are individuals in, for example, my previous company at King, who have never really recruited at, you know, VP and above level. And so they don't understand the process, they don't understand what, you know, how in depth it goes, and indeed what the outcomes ought to look like. So there's a lot of educating, a lot of helping them to guide them through that process, really from the outset, and explaining how things are going to go. And then also to manage expectations that candidates aren't going to fall on their in their inboxes in week one. It just doesn't work that way. So there's quite a lot of educating to be done, and that's for me the fundamental difference.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think finding the talent or identifying the talent is probably 20% of your role. Driving, facilitating, bringing people together to drive a decision is the most complex. And you need to understand the metrics of your organization and really rely on different group to help drive those decisions. So again, going back to your question, it depends on some of the business challenges that your company wants to solve. And one great advice I was given is when you go for a briefing or kickoff, call it as you wish, try to really get under the skin of the company strategy, vision, roadmap. So the first conversation I have with hiring manager, I ask, and that's probably one advantage that we have compared to external vendors, which may not access that data for confidentiality purpose. I would ask hiring manager, send me your company deck, your strategy deck for the next 2 years. And that's going to drive the whole conversation up to understanding the kind of leader who will help us scale to X billion.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Sorry, Adam, you're going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the what Keen and Alia just said there reminds me of, it's a sports analogy, but when you, a couple of years ago, Juventus signed Ronaldo for like 100 million or something crazy like that. And, you know, people were going, that's a ridiculous amount of money. He's like 35. He's, you know, he's only got a couple of years left in his playing career, but he sold 100 million worth of shirt sales the day he joined that club. That is the magnitude of the kind of like senior exec hiring, is they are going to shift the needle for that business. And that like 1% could be millions and millions, or, you know, hundreds of millions of, you know, revenue worth. So it's very, very different. And what Alia just said about, you know, identifying the people, that's the very first bit. That's, you know, it's from there that the search actually really starts. So it's a big different thing.
Okay, I really like the idea that the splitting of the time commitment is maybe one of the biggest differences then from someone who's a recruiter, you know, just recruiting below VP level, so to speak, compared to senior level. Actually, you got to get them all in the room. How do you align them to agree on the role, agree on the person, how to assess, how to actually make the hiring decision? That may in fact be, you know, the bulk of the job, because you know, you've got a lot of probably strong-willed people, all of them confident in their own view. I'm sure, you know, that is generally the case when you end up in the leadership position. And to get them all aligned, that might be very difficult. How is it, would it be fair to say in a scale-up, there is a larger volume of senior exec roles to recruit for? So it's not just one job, right? Like, what is the average? How many are you recruiting for at the moment? What's the requirement count? Is that a fair question?
I don't know if my boss is listening. definitely more than executive search, right? Definitely more than, you know, I think exec search will probably take on 4 or 5 assignments and would have
at any one time, Alia, right?
Yeah, at any one time. So, but we do, you know, there's a different dynamic with also internal hiring. Okay. I would say, I don't know if I can give a number, to be honest, Hung. It will vary. Okay. It will vary. It will be a healthy number, will be probably around 8 to 10 internally. And still, it is a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot of work, right? How about you, Keane? Have you got a thought? Is there a number, like number of requirements that's possible for one like internal exec search person to be managing?
Yeah, I think there is. I think, it depends on the stage that they're at in the different processes, of course, and also if there's any search firm or indeed research firm support being added. I think it also depends on the structure of your own in-house team, whether or not you've got in-house research, you've got in-house coordination, scheduling, and administrative support as well. My magic number is 7. The minute a recruiter goes beyond 7, I start to worry.
Yeah.
And if they're hitting 10, I immediately go out for support with different areas. Mm-hmm. I think it's you're able to deliver 10 searches, again, with that caveat just mentioned, but the quality of the work is not as good. And executive recruiting is so costly if you get it wrong, I think years and years ago, there's some research done on how costly it actually was. And again, another magic number of 7 came up, which was the cost of the salary times 7 was the cost of getting the hire wrong. So which can, you know, in some situations can be very, very large numbers. So for me, 7, I think, is your magic number when it comes to exec recruiting.
Tell me about the support you two. Like you mentioned, you know, exec search, maybe it's one person. Possibly if in a certain size of company, you might just be the person that is a 360 recruiter. You have to do it all. But in a slightly different, or maybe not. I mean, I don't know. Is it even possible for one person to do it all? Is there such a thing as, right, you're owning the relationship management internally, you're also doing the search, the outreach, all of the assessment, everything, you're the one person. Is that doable, or is there usually some sort of research function, or do you typically engage external suppliers to at least fulfill some of that approach?
I think it depends on the volumes you're handling, right? I mean, if you're going to do, I don't know, 8-10 hires a year, then you could probably do it on your own. With a little bit of help from outside, but I think, you know, for example, at Zalando, we hired north of 40 execs last year, and we're certainly going to be hiring north of 60 this year. And so the team that's being built there is very much in some ways a carbon copy of what you get in search firms, though slightly the pyramid is inverted. So we've got more recruiters because the engagement is critical. We have fewer researchers because they support on a broader level, but do a lot of the hard work. And then, of course, you know, coordination is, you know, the administrative support is of course in-house much less than it would be from a search firm's perspective. So the team will be around, well, last year to deliver 40 something searches, there was four of them, four and a half of them. And by the end of this year, we will be at six or seven.
Yep. Interesting. Very interesting. What's the setup like in, I mean, again, no confidentiality breaches here, Alia, but I'm interested to know, you know, the structure of an mm-hmm. internal exec search function. Is there a pattern of play? Does it look similarly? You've got a bunch of researchers, then you've got like effectively recruiters that do the outreach. They're the person that does first touch contact with these executives.
So Hong, ServiceNow is a rocket ship. Since I joined, we've tripled the size of our talent acquisition. Okay, so there's a lot of history. I don't think we have enough time here. We have a global executive search team. So I am the only one so far in EMEA, and I do have peers, six peers in the US, and soon one peer, hopefully, who will join us in APJ. So it's been a one-woman show so far with the help of course, you know, coordination support and from time to time sourcing support as well. But we're moving fast, and often you can't have, because you're moving so fast, you don't have the luxury of having predictability, right? So the volume comes at you, you manage. Now, obviously, where there were instances where the volume was above 10, you know, I would get additional support. Condition, strictly confidential hiring would go to searches, just to avoid any
External recruiters, right? You would use
Yes, external. But that's probably 10% mm-hmm. of my volume. We don't have too many of those. So it will depend. It's difficult for us to predict volume with our pace today.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Okay, I've noticed the time we're flying through. So I want to get to the point of contact. How do we do this? So a researcher or an exec search firm or myself, I've generated a list of people I think are suitable. How do I approach them? Do I use an email? I mean, how do I do it?
It depends. So I think, you know, first of all, going back to that kickoff meeting, understanding the strategy. You know, it's about sharing the vision. And I think someone in the chat mentioned it's not about, you know, I never have an interview with the first conversation. It's really about establishing mutual interest. It takes further conversation to really get someone into the process often. So I always tell leaders, you know, you need to consider really the four P's when considering a new opportunity. Look at the people, product, look at the potential of the company, and understand.
Oh,
we have indeed. Let's see whether she's managed to come back.
Oh, I want to hear what that fourth P is.
So do I. but okay, whilst Alia is getting back on stream there, hopefully we can get her back. But that's, you know, how about you, Keen? Let's throw the same question out at you. I've identified the right candidate. What's the best way to approach first contact?
Well, as Ali, I think, was going to say, I think that the conversation, the approach to a candidate isn't about a job. It really is about understanding where they're at in their career, what they're thinking of next, what's going to challenge them. More often than not, they are seeking to leave a legacy of some kind. And of course, be rewarded for it. So it really is I think it's more of an approach and a get to know you to start off with.
Can I stop you there just a moment, Keen, sure. Because we've just had multiple people that I think are from the search industry have just confirmed that very clearly. It's not about the role. So you can't go in pitching, hey, this is an amazing job. No, it has to be about what the individual is looking for. And it's an open conversation. What is the opener? How can you give us an opener you might use, Keen? This is a very busy C-level person, very busy senior leader. Like, how do you open the conversation?
I try and find somebody who knows them. I will ask that person, hopefully will give me a little bit of insight into what is, you know, what they're interested in outside of work. It could be I remember approaching somebody for our Success Factors CEO role, and the individual was a petrol head, loves racing around circuits, and I happened to do so too. So it, the approach, admittedly via LinkedIn in that situation, was very much, you know, I hear from so-and-so that you're a bit of a petrol head and would love to have a chat. So it had nothing to do with the job really, or what we were trying to do. And I can't remember, I think it was about 6 months later or 3 months later, something like that, we started talking about the actual opportunity and what the role would look like. So I think it's slowly catching monkey, as they say.
Yep. So it's about slow relationship building. It's not like firing off, here's the job description, are you interested? That's just not going to work at this level. And it probably wouldn't work at many other levels, to be honest with you. It's one of the worst things I think recruiters do is try and close too quick. You know, especially for the highly skilled in demand, you can't treat them as applicants to your job. If they're highly skilled and in demand, they're getting these interactions all the time. You can't be forcing them to make decisions. You've got to present them some interest, an interesting path that they can go through at their own pace. Okay, Alia, let's go and keep going.
Can I just quickly add to that, that something I heard last a couple of days ago, somebody in exec resourcing told me that it takes 8 points of contact to get a response from a female and 2 to get a response from a male.
That's very interesting.
It is very interesting.
Well, hang on, are we talking about leadership here or just...
Yes. At the exec level, only working at the exec level, 8 points of contact to get a female to reply and 2 to get a male to reply.
I believe that it may actually be replicable through other tiers as well. I think there's some sort of research to say that you do need more connection points to get a response. There's gender variance in that, but I'm not sure what it is leadership-wise. Mm-hmm. I'll definitely ask these two about it. But let's talk about your final P there, Alia, before we're missing the P.
Purpose.
Purpose. Okay, fantastic. Opener. So LinkedIn, I think, is good to use, right? There's no reason why LinkedIn is a bad place. Is this the channel that you would use to go and make first contact, Alia?
LinkedIn, obviously, you build your network. And as someone mentioned here, you know, it does take time. I made hires after, I think, having a first touch point 18 months before because there was no right opportunity. So it's really nurturing those relationships over time, but LinkedIn and you know what, we need to I don't know, Kin, if you'll agree, but you need to demystify, you know, exec hiring. You might have an individual contributor role that is even more tricky and that have a greater impact. Okay, so I think it's important sometimes to demystify. LinkedIn is a great place. Referrals, although I'm probably going to be the devil advocate here, I'm not a believer in cultural fit, especially because we're looking to innovate and scale. We're looking to leaders who are going to bring a different perspective and value. So referrals, but I try to limit those, else it gets political.
Yeah, and you can't advertise, right? Usually advertising, is that a technique that's useful or what do you get from
it? It depends. I mean, it's...
you can do.
There's some sort you can advertise, others that, you know, you might probably waste people time because you're addressing a very niche or a very small TAM. So it depends. It's just a conscious decision you have to make.
Where would be a good place to advertise for a senior exec role for a rapid tech scale-up then? Would that be LinkedIn as well, or is there another place that would be useful?
No, probably LinkedIn.
Yeah, cool. That's good to know, folks, because LinkedIn is quite a mature, and I'm not saying executives are necessarily more mature, but the chances are they've put some time into their careers to reach a level of experience. And we know LinkedIn demographic, I think the sweet spot is like late 20s into the 40s. So it's actually not a bad network to get busy with when it comes down to hiring. Okay, I'm going to move really quickly, folks. I want to final question for you two. there's a young person there that's in an exec function, exec search function. What's the bit of advice you would give to that person in order to develop their career and move forward and be a very successful executive recruiter? Any tips that you can give from your experience? Go to you first, Keen.
I think it's really about understanding the business strategy and how the business works and ultimately how the business makes money itself. And then you can start to translate that into what you should be doing to align and to develop yourself in that way. If you don't understand how the business makes money, then I think you're going to struggle as an executive recruiter to really translate how a candidate is going to be applicable to a role. Because ultimately they're there to build the bottom line, and more so than everyone else is in the company, or at least more visibly so. So I think that's really one area. The other area is think before you speak. Executives will listen to you if they feel that you have thought things through, that you are listening to what they have to say, and that you're responding from a place of thought and, of course, experience and knowledge. So do less of the ums, which I do frequently, and do much more of the listening and then responding, and then giving an opinion and a reason for that opinion.
Excellent. How about you, Alia? Bit of advice for a person like currently in their career in corporate exec recruiting.
Yeah, so I'd probably business acumen, so Keen mentioned, absolutely take time to understand the business, the pain point of your leaders as well. Be that confident, but also your partner, you know, leads. I mean, I've never been driven by title. So lead with integrity. Don't be afraid to say no, even it's your C-suite, if it comes to making the right hiring decision. Do not be afraid to say no. I think that's really important. Don't be an order taker. Really be embedded into your leadership strategy, which I think here we are lucky at that level. They truly see talent elevation and talent at a core pillar of their strategy.
That's really good advice. And I think advice that people can take in any field of work, you know, don't devalue what it is you do. You know, you're in the room for a reason. Okay, great. Thank you so much, you two. Please hang around for the rest of the show. We've got a couple more minutes left. I'm going to bring on one more person. And so I've got to say goodbye to you off screen for the time being, Alia and Keen.
Thank you.
Great to have you on the show.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your questions.
So very, very interesting. You've got to say something, Adam.
Yeah, this is funny. So I've heard, because I've been spending a bit of time in this area recently, one thing I heard that was very funny was it's not uncommon for potential leadership candidates to have their PA arrange their interview with your organization. So the exec recruiter is literally liaising with the potential candidate's PA for them to potentially move out of that business.
I mean, the inbox is not something they've looked at for a long time. Anyway, we've got our final guest on, which I'm delighted to welcome. And it's a really early morning for you, Dave. I hope it's not too early for you. Dave Perry, great to have you on the show. For the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do, sir?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you very much. And greetings from the other side of, greetings from the colonies. My name is David Perry. I'm the managing partner of Perry Martell International. It's an executive search firm that my partner and I have owned and operated for 33 years. My business partner is also my wife. So I've been in the business for 35 years. She funded the business 33 years ago. So that's how we started. I'm the author of a couple of books, which are germane to the conversation today. Executive Recruiting for Dummies is the last one I wrote. The year before that, I wrote Hiring Greatness, How to Recruit Your Dream Team and Crush the Competition. And I have written all three editions of Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters, which I obviously are done for candidates. I've done 1,587 searches myself.
You've counted them, Dave?
Yeah, you got to have some fun, man. You really do. And we're now, I've closed more than 400, and I've negotiated more than $401 million in salaries. We have a 1-year guarantee, and I've replaced six people. We specialize in tech in a couple of areas, SaaS in particular, construction. It was finally nice to go and walk Canary Wharf. We were involved decades ago. It wasn't until 2 years ago that I went and saw the shard.
And actually saw it. Yeah, amazing.
Well, and, Dave, and real estate.
Dave, listen, I mean, I'm really interested to know about your perspective from, as you say, the other side. So we've heard from the exec recruiters from the corporate perspective, where they're internally embedded teams recruiting out. I want to hear from your side as a third party. So you're going to these companies, or they're coming to you, and they're saying, "Hey, we're hiring for this person." What is the things that you've learned through all of these searches, which kind of makes a leader different at a different level? Is there a consistent sort of quality that you've seen, or is it like very much dependent, role dependent, company dependent, context dependent, if you like?
Well, as Jane said, it's very much contextual, right? But there is one thing that is common in all the searches that I only noticed a couple of years ago and could articulate it a couple of years ago. And that's the fact that the best candidate, the best people are going to come to a company not to make more money. Full stop. You can't pitch. You can't pitch, first of all, and you can't pitch money. They're going to come to the organization because of what it stands for and what it's going to achieve. So if anything, in Jane's terms, in Keane's terms, you're selling the dream. And that's what you go out with. You can't go out and sell the dream until you've had the deep conversation and reached a common ground and a common understanding on what the real needs are. And then you can go out and court. And that's what you're doing. You're going out and courting. And, you know, we've been on searches where we've narrowed it down to the point where there's maybe 25 people on the globe that can do a job the way it needs to be done. CTOs are a good example. We're just finishing one off now. There are three people on the planet that can, literally three people on the planet that can pull off this one particular job. And if we're fortunate, in the next couple of weeks, we close it up. If we're not, we go on to the next person down. But it has been a four-month full court press according to this individual. And, you know, we're talking about LinkedIn a couple seconds ago. I don't know if you guys have – I used to play rugby, but are you guys familiar with baseball cards?
Sure.
Okay, so – Perfect analogy on how you find the people you're looking for. You can do this. LinkedIn is like a baseball card, right? When you define the market that's going to have the person who's got the experience, skills, and probably the attitude that you need to hunt in, you can go to LinkedIn and you can look at their stats. How many touchdowns do they run? How many hits do they have? The stats are there. And if you go through those things and figure out and you familiarize yourself with the statistics of what somebody's done, and you can go to their Facebook page if they've got one, and a lot of them do, even executives, and find out what they're interested in. Then, you know, this is three-dimensional chess. You can match up what your client's trying to do with skills and experience. That's wonderful, but what does the candidate do, or what do they think, or what are they passionate about, and is there a connection? And that's how you start these conversations that we're talking about. Does that answer that question, Hung, or is that just too high level?
It was certainly something. You know what, you took me that on a journey there, Dave. I thought it was fascinating to hear your thought process more than anything. You've actually pulled, there's another thread I want to just dive into here, which was like, when do you know that the interest is there or not? Is there a point where you recognize, okay, this person may be ideal, but the interest isn't there? So for instance,
that's an excellent question. I couldn't have prompted. Sorry, do you want me to answer? Or do you want to finish your question?
Well, I was just saying that, you know, Adam mentioned it takes eight hits to get a response. I mean, at what point are you harassing someone, or at what point do you know, okay, I've got to take the message? Is there a formula to this, or again, is it just like you got to play it as you see it?
Well, you know, I think it's all in the research. We got a research team. It's all in the research, and it's all in your initial message. And then it's a matter of making sure that they actually got the message. And I can give you an example. The Wall Street Journal did an article on me, you know, a decade ago, where they nicknamed me the rogue recruiter. And they did that because there's one particular guy I really, really wanted. And it took 51 phone calls. The last of which was in a rented car on the Autobahn. It's in the paper, where he finally took my call. But the first 50 calls, he didn't. Now I needed a CEO for a tech startup. And, you know, when you take on a startup role, when you take on any executive search, I think you need to understand you're there to finish it. You're in it to win it. That's it. If you take the role, you have to deliver. You know, it's been 33 years. We've never failed to finish a project, ever. But that takes commitment. So going back to answering your question, when do I know? Ours is process. So when we'll do a SWOT analysis with the client, and then we'll go nice and deep, and then we'll do a position profile, okay, that, you know, clearly articulates the role. And it's probably anywhere from 6 to 10 pages. So it talks about the role, talks about the company, so that when the candidate or the prospect is reading this, they can actually see themselves in the role. So you with me so far?
Yeah.
So that's happening on my end. I do that kind of stuff. And then we got a research team that goes and gives me this big long list of, here are all the people that you said you wanted to talk to. So here's what we do. I call every single one of them and talk to every single one of them. And I say, hi, my name is David Perry, and I'm the author of, I'll either say Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters, because everybody's heard of that book, or Executive Recruiting for Dummies, or the both. And I'll say, and I'm also the managing partner of Perry Martell International, which is an executive search firm that specializes in whatever I'm recruiting for that role. And I say, we've never met. Only reason for the phone call today is I want to get a confidential email address, and I want to ship you some information. And if I got them live on the phone, they'll say, well, tell me about the jobs. No, I'm not a good sales guy. In fact, I couldn't possibly do this justice. Just let me send you this document. And very, very, very rarely will anybody refuse. So we send out the document. And if we've done it right, and we do, they'll get this, they'll read it, and they'll go, oh, my God. And then they'll call me back, and they'll say, let's talk about this job. And I go, no, don't want to talk about job. I want to talk about you. Before I want to talk about you, I don't know you. So I'm going to send you this Word document. It's called the confidential candidate brief, because you're not looking for a job. 99.9% of the people I talk to aren't looking for a job. So I'm just going to send you this confidential candidate brief. You're going to read it, type in a couple of answers to the questions, and then send it back to me. And then we'll talk, because then I've read it and I will sound so smart.
And can I just stop you there, David? I hope everyone's paying attention to this, because this is like a really very interesting psychological move, in the sense that you kind of switch away from being a person pitching and being a supplicant to the candidate. What you're doing is you're really making the individual come to you, and that changes the relationship entirely. I think that's a really fantastic way to think about it. So you're not pitching on the phone. You're saying, no, I'm not going to tell you about it. You need to digest this information, and then we'll talk. I love that way of approaching things, David. Go ahead.
Thank you. And the reason it works is because you're changing the dynamic, and you're making the prospect who's the hunted become the hunter.
Right. Exactly. Right? Exactly.
So, and more than that, after they've, you know, if they fill in the confidential candidate brief, and like I said, you know, 99% of the time they do, we have this conversation, I'm not pitching. They're auditioning. And all I'm going to ask is the same question I've asked for 25 years. Roll me back to when you're getting out of college or university, whatever, and take me through your career and tell me what's important, and I'll sit and listen. And most people can do this in under an hour. Some of them can't. That's fine. It's fascinating. But what you find out in the process is why they've made different moves. Were they pushed out? Were they brought along by a mentor? Or did they see the market clearly, or see a market opportunity clearly? Because everybody has patterns. Everybody has patterns. You just want to understand what theirs are. And then we go back to Jane's, you know, comments on the scorecard, because we've got a scorecard. You're lining this up. Do the skills and experience match? Yeah, we already knew that. We did that with the research piece, right? So we're talking to the right people. Now, you know, does their attitude, does the way they think mesh or add value to the rest of the team that you're trying to build them with? And, you know, as I think it was Elia said, you know, we're not necessarily looking for people that all think the same. You know, we're not. Down here in Canada, or over here in Canada, you know, we did one of the, we did two of the first SaaS, official SaaS startups ever, hiring their VP of sales, and complete different teams. And we took the, we recruited three guys, and then we took the first two guys, actually all three, and took the first two guys into the company. And we hired one of them. He was a drummer. He's actually appeared on Wembley Stadium. Drumming with the Who, great guy, Rudy Richmond, look him up. Anyway, but his style would not have, we put him into a company called Protus IP. There were 7 million. 5 years later, they exited. They were doing 77 million. Okay, exited for a big nut. We took a similar guy that we had presented to Protus, but didn't have the same metronome. We took him to a company called Halogen. You guys are familiar with Halogen. You got him over the UK. And he took them from 3 million to 24 million in his first year there. Completely different styles of working, completely different styles of rolling out to the marketplace, as Jane would say.
You know what? That's a really important learning for me, Dave, in the sense that this idea of contextual leadership, right? In the sense that, yes, this person may be a great leader, but you have to understand like what environment, what team, what setup they're going into, because that style or that approach may not be appropriate in every case. So that's like one of the key kind of things I've taken from this this amazing conversation we've had so far. David, listen, we're like speeding towards the end of this show. So I've got to kind of ask you a final question, really as an input, bit of advice, I would say, for a company that is, you know, thinking about expanding their leadership team. What is the first things that they need to be doing before they engage in the search? What's the thing they've got to get right? Like in your experience of engaging with all of these hundreds of companies, you must have encountered a number of situations where you thought, you know what, these guys have not got this component correct for me to execute on this. What is that mistake and why should they avoid it?
Get naked.
Can you explain what you mean? Yeah, I think I get it.
Crazy Canadian. And we've done this on five continents, so it's the same with everybody. Get naked at the interview or get naked at the intake. We're going to come into a company, my partner and I, and we're going to ask questions to get to the bottom of who you really are, how you're structured, how you think, you know, who's going to work here. And we've got pretty finely tuned BS detectors. So if you bullshit us during one of these intake calls, we'll give you the, we'll call it. We'll call you right then and there. You got one chance. Second call, we'll thank them and hire up. And you know, I have talked about this over the years. I got a call from a guy, God, how long ago was it? Maybe 5 or 6 years ago. He wanted us to hire a new VP of sales for him. So I went down to have this conversation. And I said, well, you know, take me through the last X number of years and tell me what's been going on. So he takes me through in about 3 minutes, the overview of the company over the last 5 years and what was wrong with all six VPs of sales that he'd hired and fired. And what was the question he asked me? Oh, then he said, listen, I'm going to hire you and either you're going to get it right because you got the reputation for doing this, or I'm going to sell the company. And I said, what do you mean sell the company? He said, well, I got an offer on the table now. I said, take it. He said, what do you mean, take it? I said, take it. The mere fact that you have to ask me why you should take it is disturbing enough. But if you haven't clued in that you're the problem, you're the common element. You know, like six VPs of sales. Okay, I know five of the guys you hired because I did my research. And they're not who I'd hire, but I wouldn't have hired them. So why did you? And you don't know the answer to that. We can't help. He actually did sell the company about 2 months later, and two of his investors turned out to be friends of mine. I didn't know they were investors. And they called me and said, what did you say to him? And I took them to the conversation. It was the right conversation. So advice, get real, be naked. Be naked at the intake. Yeah. Be naked at the interview. Confess your sins, because by God, we're going to find them. And we need to find them before the candidates do, because a prospect is not a candidate. A prospect is a prospect. And once they become a candidate and they start digging in, they're going to find out what's wrong with you, and you need to know it, and we needed to know it ahead of time so that we can buffer whatever it is we're working on to solve that issue. We got a new book. Just one quick thing. We got a new book, and this is, I think, important for most people. We got a new book coming out. I don't know when, but it's called Revolutions Need Leaders, How to Recruit an Industry 4.0 Leader. Because the leaders that we need now, Jane talked about this, Elliot talked about this, Keane talked about this, the type of leaders we need now are not the ones that are coming screaming out of the, you know, the third industrial revolution. No, the fourth industrial revolution is all about knowledge and how you treat people. It's not about the bits and bytes. It's not about the bleeds and feeds. It's how do you maximize the creative potential of the people that you're working with. And by God, if they don't love you, if they don't trust you, the game is finished. It's that simple.
It sounds like a book. You need to let me know when you publish it, David. I'd be very keen to have a copy of it. Well, listen, David, we are coming to the end of the show. So we've got to say goodbye at this point. And I do thank you for your time. I know you had to get up super early to have this to participate here. So I want to thank you on that. I know you say you get up early, but it's like I really don't like getting people out of bed before 9, you know. But thank you very much for participating. We'd love to get you back at some other point. We do this show every Friday. We're going to start varying the times a little bit more, I think, in order to be a little bit more US friendly. So North American friendly, should I say. And hopefully we'll get the chance to bring you back later on in the year, David.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
No worries. Great to see you, sir. How fascinating was that? I think every guest could really, again, another example where we could get like every guest needs to have their own show. Ridiculous. Anyway, I think that's about it. We're running well over time, folks. So we've got to kind of cut it short there. Sorry we couldn't get to the questions. I do apologize to everybody who I instructed to ask questions in the ask questions section. I'm really sorry. We haven't got to it. But we're going to be cutting off there. Thank you again to our sponsors, E6. They are a network for internal corporate exec recruiters. You should check them out if you're interested in this show. Absolutely, make sure you apply or register to their website, or get in touch with Simon Mullins. He's actually been in the chat stream all the way through. I'm sure he'll be happy to have a chat with you about it. We'll be back with you next week. What are we talking about? Oh, we're talking about post-pandemic retention. Do you have a plan, folks? Apparently, everyone's going to quit their jobs as soon as you tell them to get back into the office. I think an element of that may be true. Do you have a plan about it? We've got an amazing lineup of people from Nestle is going to be there. We're going to have Kelly Services there. We're going to have Harvey Nash Group is going to be there. We've got some amazing guests. We've got Mervyn Dinnan as well, if you know him. And that will be a fascinating discussion on how do you retain staff. Follow the channel if you want to get an update on that. Okay, that's about it. Have a good weekend. We'll see you soon. Anyway, that's it for the show. Adam, I need to ask you a question before I let you go. Mm-hmm. Did you read, was it Floyd Mayweather has signed to fight?
Oh, I know, Logan Paul.
Logan Paul.
Oh, no, come on. Have some dignity. Just go and spend your money. Stop.
There's no dignity when there's hundreds of millions to be earned.
That's got enough. The guy doesn't need more. Logan Paul, come off it.
No, but here's the reality. Here's the reality. Pay-per-view, Logan Paul may well be the most popular boxer on the planet right now.
Well, Jake Paul, maybe. I mean,
they should fight each other. Really.
Brothers, the one.
You know what? They should do that. The brothers fight, and I think a lot of people will pay money to see one of them get beaten up.
But Jake Paul against Tommy Fury, that is actually worth watching because they're probably probably not far off in levels. Neither of them have had that many fights.
Is this ridiculous thing to say that we should get like a brain food boxing tournament up?
Against you,
different weight class, mate. Although you got to watch my power to weight ratio, mate. It's like quite impressive, to be honest. But I wonder whether that's like good TV. Like, would you pay money to see Adam in a boxing ring with some other person in recruiting? Is that money?
I'd like to watch. Ken Ward against Jacob Madsen, for example.
Oh my God, I would pay money for that. Front row seat for that.
One quick question for you. Tomorrow night, Parker Chisora who's winning that.
That's a tough call. I don't know.
Really, it is.
I think any
Parker's a better boxer, but Chisora's just a beast.
But Chisora's how old now, and how many times has he been to the well?
36, 37.
He may be, but in the amount of fights he's had, he's like 65. Like he, the rolling in. I reckon Parker's got it, to be honest.
Yeah. Probably Parker on points, I would expect. But, you know, Chisora did pretty well against Usyk, and Usyk's better than Parker. So.
Which exactly why Chisora's going to lose. That's his career. You know, he zigs and zags his way through his entire career. Anyway, that's it, folks. You have a good weekend.
Cheers.